Welcome to the Talking to Ourselves podcast. I'm Omid Farhang, founder at Majority. My guest today, Stephanie Natty Olson, founder of We Are Rosie, described as a community of independent marketing experts available on demand to complement, backfill, or accelerate in-house team capabilities on both the brand and agency side. We Are Rosie puts together mission-focused teams from its community of 7,500 independent marketers and small business owners, spanning former Fortune 500 CMOs to PR mavens to media and technology strategists and so much more. Stephanie founded We Are Rosie in 2018. Just 2 years later, she was named Ad Age Visionary of the Year. She was recognized by Adweek in the 2020 Creative 100. She was named World Changing Woman 2020 by Conscious Company. And she was awarded Entrepreneur of the Year in 2019 by the Stevie Awards. She is a mother, a boss, and an entrepreneur I've been eager to connect with since moving to Atlanta. This is Stephanie Natty Olson and I talking to ourselves. Stephanie Natty Olson, where are you from and what did your parents do?
I am from Atlanta, Georgia, born and raised, educated. I went to Georgia Tech here in the city, so I haven't made it. I always say I haven't made it very far from the nest. Yeah. My parents still live in Atlanta and neither of my parents are college educated. My dad just turned 77 and he still works full time. He's a tailor for men's suits at a mall north of Atlanta. He worked at Brooks Brothers for like 20 years as a kid, when I was a kid. And he dropped out of school when he was 8 in a refugee camp to learn how to be a tailor. So that's been his path for almost 70 years now. And my mom just retired. She was a sales manager at a company that sold servers B2B.
Where were your parents from?
So my dad's Palestinian, and he came to the States in the early 70s. And my mom's from Nebraska. So she's like one of 13 kids of German farm family in Nebraska.
And you're one of three kids, is that right?
Uh-huh. I'm the youngest of three.
We've got a lot in common. I'm the youngest of three. My parents are both from Iran. My dad came in the early 60s. My mom came in the early 70s. As I was researching, I'm like, there's a lot lining up here. So I've been very excited to talk to you. One question I like to ask is, what did 12-year-old Stephanie want to be when she grew up?
Oh my gosh. I think I just wanted to have money. So, I mean, if I'm being honest, we used somebody else's address to get me into a better school, starting when I was 6 years old. And so I grew up in this weird juxtaposition where like we didn't have wealth and my parents worked really hard to make ends meet, but I was dropped into this school with really rich kids. Like their parents were like CEOs of financial institutions and like, you know, like high level powered executives at corporations. And so I just always like existed in this space that like, I didn't feel like I belonged in, but I was fascinated. And I was like, okay, what's the difference between these people and us? Like, how do I get money and security and power like they have? And I mean, that was kind of that like definitely a light bulb moment for me at a very young age.
I reflect on my time growing up as an Iranian in Arizona and looking back for me, the Middle Eastern experience in America is thorny in a different way than the Black or Hispanic experience growing up in America. For us, I think it's mostly because a lot of Americans just view the Middle East as one giant country. So for me in the 80s, that felt like we were all Ayatollah. And then in the 90s, we were all Saddam. And then in 2001, we were all Bin Laden. And now we're all Al-Qaeda. So from a very young age, I remember just the simple act of telling people I was Iranian would sort of change their demeanor. You would sort of see like a little slight change in a facial expression. And I'm sure it's not that different when you tell somebody you're Palestinian. And so what I learned at a young age was how to fast follow with a joke or a story or a sports thing to sort of signal to them, like, don't worry, I'm cool. I'm not a scary one. Yeah, I'm not a scary one.
Yep.
And it was a term I later learned is called aspirational whiteness, which is a thing I didn't really reckon with until I decided to start my company. So that's my experience in a nutshell. I wonder how closely that may resemble your experience in a nutshell.
Yeah. You know, so I am white, super white presenting, right? And my brother and sister have very Arabic names. Their names are Omar and Najwa. So they off the bat had, you know, probably like you experienced like questions. People like came at you aggressively, like, what's your deal? What, who are you? What are you? Where do you come from? And because of my name and because our last name, Natty, is like, people don't know, people don't see that name and think, you know, it's Arabic, and it's actually El Natty, A-L hyphen Natty, but my dad had to drop it because it wouldn't fit. His full name would not fit on the immigration form. So we have a different last name than all of our cousins. So it was definitely a different experience for me because I could blend in, right? And like, people wouldn't come at me and be like, explain yourself, right? A lot of people thought I was Jewish or like Italian or whatever, but nobody sees me and thinks, oh, she's Palestinian. Unless you're Arabic or Palestinian, maybe you're like, oh. And so I had like just a really interesting experience, but it would come out, right? Like people would see my dad and his brown skin and his thick accent picking me up from school or coming to my softball games. And then the questions would come. And it was weird, right? Like you do feel like you want to own who you are, even though there's like all sorts of, for me at least, sadly, there were like feelings of shame, right? And like the just like, do I want to assimilate or do I want to tell people who I am? But it did always come with like, oh, then you have to laugh at the racist joke, or then you have to like just blend in. And as a kid, that's like a heavy, heavy thing to carry. You know, I like in high school, people were like, oh, here comes Steph, like Durka Durka Jihad. And like, it was just heartbreaking, right? That you don't know how to cope. You're a kid. So it was all sorts of weirdness, but I have been always acutely aware of the fact that because I'm white presenting and because I have an American name, I've had broadly different experiences than my brother and sister.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the career path that brought you to your entrepreneurial shift in 2018. So I think part of learning what kind of company we want to create just sort of happens through osmosis as we make our way through the corporate world. And what I really want to ask you is, what was the company you worked at that made you think it should be the opposite of this? But I will ask you the far more polite question, which is, you know, what was that job that maybe started to teach you what values were important to you and sort of showed you company culture that started to get in your bloodstream?
Yeah. So after I left AOL, I'll take it back a little further. So I worked at Microsoft, which was an incredible experience right out of college. And then I went to work at AOL during a time where they were doing rapid acquisitions. So like every week we were acquiring a startup, and I got to know the startups. And I realized in that moment that those were my people. Like I could really clearly see, this is bureaucracy at AOL. And I don't mean no shade at AOL. I worked with the brightest people I've ever worked with before I started Rosie there. But then I got to see all these startups that they were acquiring and the cultures and the hustle and the figure outerness of these startups, and also like the bond that they had. And that was the moment where I was like, these are my people. This is where I feel like home. I love creating something. I love building something. I like the fast pace. I like the entrepreneurial spirit of just like, we're going to figure it out. Like, you know, we may not know have all the answers, but we're going to figure it out. And that they could move so fast. So I found that like, that was the tempo I like to keep. And those were the people I gravitated towards at AOL that came through these acquisitions. And so from there, I went to work at a startup called Flurry, which was a mobile SDK. It sold to Yahoo. And it was such a cool startup experience because the team was like pretty diverse for a Silicon Valley venture-backed startup. And they were just really open and honest. It was my first time having an Arabic boss. The CEO was an Arabic guy named Simon Khalaf. And they were just, it was just an incredible experience. And that was the true, like being part of something that's being built. The plane is being built while we're flying. I mean, it was just a nutty time to be there, but I absolutely loved it. And that was really, I think, kind of solidified for me that like, this is the path I want to take, but it had also given me the experience of like, the people who are building these companies are not that different from me. Like they don't have some superpower that I don't have. They're not some like mythical creature that, you know, is one in a billion that can start a company. Like I could do it too. And so that was really the moment where I think, I don't know if I had like realized it really, but I think it kind of codified for me that like, I can do this and I really want to do it on my own.
Yeah. It sounds like your first experience at AOL was transformative, and you're working for the big company. You're going to talk to your people who happen to be on the other side of the table. Was it a lot of like, so I need to relay some information to you that I'd really rather not relay to you on behalf of the company?
It was, so AOL was an interesting place because it had just gotten so bureaucratic before Tim Armstrong came on. He like joined from Google, and I had joined right before Tim Armstrong took over as CEO. And the bureaucracy was astounding. And Tim Armstrong came on and was like, I can't remember the exact percentage, but he was very honest. And he said, we're going to have to let go of 25% of the people that work here. Like he did his tour of duty as CEO. And people were up in arms, and the loss of jobs is absolutely heartbreaking. Nobody wants to see that. But I remember at that age, I was probably 24. I thought that's actually what needs to happen. There's so much bureaucracy here that we can't get anything done. Right. Like there's people who I'm pretty sure their job is to sit on an email for 2 days before they forward it. And so it was just, I learned so much. I was so young, but I was just like really soaking it all in. And I was in New York like every week for work, and I'm an early bird. So I get up at like 6 a.m. I start working typically. And I would go to the AOL New York office at like 6 a.m. because Tim Armstrong was the only person there. And I would get to listen to him on the phone. Like I knew where he hung out. And I was like, this 24-year-old being in proximity to the CEO. But I just wanted to hear how he talked about our business and how he thought about it, and got to have some brief conversations with him. But it was definitely a transformative experience for me.
I'm going to come back to that. That connects well to another question I have for you. But first, let's just lay a little groundwork here for listeners who may not know your company or who've heard of your company, but aren't sure exactly what it is. How do you describe We Are Rosie?
Yeah, We Are Rosie is a community of 7,500 independent or freelance marketers that come together for project-based work with the biggest brands and agencies in the world. And we act as that connection point. So we're connecting this really fragmented independent or freelance creator economy and marketing with these global brands so that people have the opportunity to work in a way that makes sense for them, in this case, independently, and also get the career that they desire and deserve.
It's funny, as I researched you, like last year, it was a community of 6,000. And then a recent article was a community of 6,500. And so things must be going well, because that number just seems to keep sort of inching up.
It really does. I can't keep up.
Yeah. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs I've found always wanted to be entrepreneurs. They were sort of born needing that independence and that autonomy. I personally never thought I'd be an entrepreneur. I sort of liked holding company advertising. You know, they allow you to have very soft hands. You know, the snacks are really good. They book all your flights for you. Like, it's a pretty good life. Was entrepreneurialism something that was always in your master plan? I know you said it was sort of about financial security first, but maybe the question is, when did you start to get the inkling that, like, at some point, I'm going to have to probably go it alone here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was probably, the time I knew that I wanted to go it alone was when I had an absolutely dreadful experience working for somebody else and thought, oh my God, I don't ever want to do this again. I don't want to risk even this ever happening for the rest of my career. And I've got a long career ahead of me. So like, what's the best way to mitigate not working for an asshole for the rest of my career? And that was like, I'm going to be the boss. So that was kind of that moment. But when I look back, and everything always ties together in retrospect, right? But it, to your point, like in the meantime, you're just kind of going through the steps of your life. I was entrepreneurial at a very young age, you know, like even as basic as like selling Girl Scout cookies. Like, I'll be damned if I'm not the Girl Scout selling the most cookies. And I was pounding the pavement and, you know, really enjoyed kind of creating something as small as that was. And then, you know, in the summers, my parents were like, you can go to Y camp, or you can, you know, or your only other option is to go to work with your mom. And I went to work with my mom. Like, that was what I looked forward to every summer. So I've always just like, and they would pay me like $2 a day, right? But like, I was like, I can make money over here. This is where it's at. And so that kind of translated into several other, you know, minor entrepreneurial experiences for me. When I was at Georgia Tech, I started kind of a one-woman business tutoring the football and basketball players. So I would like sign up for classes with them and then help them with everything in terms of like note-taking and helping them prepare for tests and like tutoring them and teaching them. And so, you know, there's always been something. I've always had something going, and I realized that I don't really feel comfortable without having like 10 things going at once, you know? Yeah. So tutoring athletes was like one of 5 jobs I had while I was at college. And so that's just kind of always been my personality. And I think that dreadful experience working for somebody else was the kick in the ass I needed to be like, hey, you should go do something at scale, right? Like, you should just take control of your life and build something that's really meaningful for you.
That's amazing. I mean, you have these deep roots in Atlanta. And I know for me, part of my obsession with leaving a holding company and creating a company in Atlanta is just observing that for 2 decades, I've been hearing about this diversity problem in advertising. And then I moved to Atlanta, and immediately you see how one of the most diverse cities in America is powering the film industry and the music industry, and essentially just being this driver for pop culture, which is part of the business that agencies are supposed to be in, either creating or reverberating in pop culture. This is to say nothing of the number of Fortune 500 companies that are in Atlanta. What does Atlanta mean to you? What does it mean to start a business in Atlanta for you?
Yeah. You know, so on a deeply personal level, it was the only option for me. So my entire career, I have been pestered and pushed and, you know, strongly encouraged to leave Atlanta. So literally, you know, I'm pretty ambitious. When do I get the promotion? When's the next step for me? And I don't know how many times people said, when you move to New York, you move your family to New York? What if you just come to New York for 2 years? What about LA? What about San Francisco? And so for me, because I was raised in a refugee family, we were like, what was embedded in us at a very young age was you don't leave your family, right? So my dad lost both of his parents, or his mom at a very young age, and his dad when he came to the States. And so when you go through that and your family is uprooted from their homes and put into a camp, I get why my dad is like, we stick together. And so my brother, my sister and I, and all of our kids, we're all here in Atlanta. So no, we've never left and we never will, because I think it would actually give my dad a heart attack if his family was split up again. And so that was just like, it was an imperative for me, but also like, what a gift. Like, I feel like it was such a gift to be raised in this town. And to your point, like to have gone to schools where, you know, white was not the majority, and to see people who come from different backgrounds and like really have this melting pot of a city has just been simply incredible. As I grew up, and even to go to Georgia Tech here in Atlanta, which is a big engineering school, like the diversity at Georgia Tech is pretty incredible. There weren't a lot of women while I was there, but like, I really enjoyed getting to know all the international students and to build those types of relationships. It really kind of broadened my horizons, even though I had never left the city of Atlanta. And so I love getting to run We Are Rosie from Atlanta. Of course, we don't really have, like, I'll call Atlanta our headquarters, but we've never had an office. Our team has always been distributed. We're in four different time zones in the US. But this is home. Like, it feels like home. This is where I want my family to be, and I want my kids to grow up, and I want them to experience the culture that you talked about. It's been transformative for me. You know, like, it's just, I love this town. It's got such a special place in my heart. And one last thing I'll say that was always so interesting for me, to your point about the number of Fortune 500 brands that are headquartered here in Atlanta. It was just always so sad to me throughout my career to see all of these brands sending their agency money to New York.
Yeah.
Like, it was so heartbreaking. And again, these super homogenous teams in New York running creative and media for the biggest brands in the world. It never made sense to me. And it was always like, well, there just isn't enough talent in Atlanta. That's what everybody said. There isn't enough talent. And I'm like, what? What? Like, have you spent any time in this city? So anyway, it's nice to see, you know, agencies like yours having success here and more of these brands, like, slowly, not in a big way, but slowly starting to put some of their money in this market.
Well, the talent piece is everything. You know, systemic racism sounds worse than the word just racism, but actually I think what we've learned over the past year is like the insidiousness of systemic racism is in its subtlety in convincing otherwise non-racist individuals about what's the criteria for who and who isn't qualified and who can't participate. And so we're thinking about, you know, how we source talent as an industry in such an antiquated way. And meanwhile, here is this city with so much diversity and so much creative firepower. And maybe it, you know, maybe it sort of manifests itself not through a traditional ad school, although we have those here too. And maybe not through traditional college experience, although we have a bunch of those too, including HBCUs, but also just through this sort of creator community. And it boggles my mind hearing that the criticism for all these years and decades is like, yeah, the problem is there's just this dearth of talent in Atlanta. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You're not paying attention if that's your answer.
And for the longest, we just accepted it. You know, like, I was just like, oh, well, if they say that, right? And then as I got older, I was like, this is bullshit. Yeah. Like, it's absolute bullshit. And I think, you know, I think we've all heard the adage that like, talent and creativity are evenly distributed. Opportunity is not.
Right.
And we were just not providing the opportunity for people in Atlanta. And so it's really, there was so much missed opportunity and untapped potential in this market for so long, which is a shame. It really is.
About how everyone sort of dangled the carrot of you having to move. My personal favorite in the pre-pandemic world was like a great company and a manager essentially being like, so I've met this woman, Stephanie, and she's super smart and we really want to hire her and she doesn't want to move here. So what we're going to do is we're going to attempt to trick her. We're going to tell her to come here for 1 year, but deep down we know that once she's here, she will be, you know, entangled. And for me, when I left New York, I would tell, like, I told my mentor and I told some colleagues, like, hey, I'm moving to Atlanta. New York is awesome. It just doesn't feel like home. I feel like I want to be a little one flight away from my parents. And everyone said the same thing. They all said, yeah, why has there never been a great agency in Atlanta? What they meant was, oh, you're committing career suicide. What a shame. It was going all right for you.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think it's, as we look at the landscape of it, it's not to say there haven't been great agencies in Atlanta. Of course there have been, but so often it's been a satellite office of a larger company or, you know, a company that sort of is designed in service of one big brand that's here. And it does beg the question, why hasn't there been an agency that is to Atlanta what Wieden Kennedy is to Portland, what the Martin agency is to Richmond, which is to say to tap into what makes the surrounding community unique to make the company unique.
Yeah. And this, like, this city that has been influencing national and global culture for decades, right? And that we're going to completely ignore it. I remember, you know, because I've always worked in sales, right? I've never worked at an agency. And these big sales organizations that called on agencies would view Atlanta as like such a tertiary market. Like they were like, okay, we're starting out where we're going to obviously start in New York. Then we're going to San Francisco and LA, then Chicago, then Seattle, then Houston. And I was like, do you guys know anything about like, why is Atlanta the 10th city on your list? Like there's so many brands here, so much culture and creativity here. And that was just always something that I never understood. Again, it's like such a missed opportunity.
So at the heart of your business is talent curation. And in the early going, as you built that talent network, you know, now you're at 7,500 people. But when that number was in the dozens and in the low hundreds, how hard was it to sort of figure out who you could trust? And were there times where balls were dropped and suddenly, despite having not worked at agencies, you were putting your copywriting skills to work?
Oh my gosh. I'll tell you the story of our very first project at BRFC. So I'm going to be totally honest here. It was not sexy, but we pulled it off and we were successful in the end. So our very first project was somebody that I had interviewed for a job at my last company. I had met up with her and I said, I'm building this company and we're going to connect independent talent with brands and agencies. It's going to be great. And we're going to be their kind of new biz pipeline for all these independents. Not a week later, she calls me and says, Steph, one of the holding company agencies I work with up north needs 10 freelancers immediately. You should talk to them. And this was an agency I actually hadn't worked with before. So I get on the phone with them on a Thursday. Amid, we don't have a website. I don't have insurance. We don't have like a bank account. You know what it's like getting started.
Yes.
And so they said, it's Thursday. And they said, we need 10 people to start on Monday for the 6 month project. And I, of course, say the reasonable thing. Absolutely. We can do it. No problem. 10 people. I got you. And I spent all weekend hustling and I was calling everybody I'd ever known. I was like, do you know anybody who's working independently with this skill set or that skill set? And then once we found somebody, I was like, do you have any friends? And I was like, just hounding LinkedIn myself. So it was very grassroots effort to put that team together. But we had 10 people across three time zones who had never worked together before. Actually, one of the people on the team was a former colleague of mine from AOL. And I, this goes back to Steph's never worked at an agency. One of the roles that we needed on this team was a account director. And I've been a salesperson my whole life. And salespeople are also called account directors, Omid. So I said, well, I'll do this because we're bootstrapped and like we need the money. So I'll just reinvest, you know, the payment for my role into the business. And I need to learn how this all works. This is like craziness that we're even doing this. I will never make that mistake again. I have so much respect and love for account people at an agency now. But it was a mess. Like, I was definitely scoped. I never scoped myself on a project after that. But I'm really glad I did. And it was rocky at first. We had to replace somebody on that team because they weren't showing up. But it was seamless, because what we've always encountered at We Are Rosie is that there's historically, it's starting to change. There's more people that wanted to work in this way, independently, remote, in a flexible way, than there was demand for that talent. So it was really easy for us to swap people out for the longest time. And we're now at this place where we have so much demand from brands and agencies for this talent that we're having to work really hard to make sure that we have the right talent. So our marketplace dynamics have definitely shifted over the last year. And I think COVID has certainly accelerated that. But yeah, we've had some interesting moments. But I'll say, because independents and freelancers, I mean, I think every person in our community, all 7,500, they're entrepreneurs, right? Like, they made a decision to leave corporate or leave their comfortable, you know, every 2 week paycheck job to bet on themselves. So they have a level of accountability that means that we don't really have a lot of HR issues, right? Like, these people know that if they do this work, they get the money to, you know, live their life and take care of themselves. And so we really don't have like performance issues. Of course, it happens when you're at this scale, but it's not, you know, it's not nearly as much as I had when I was leading teams in corporate.
I feel like what you really did was almost like unwittingly build the ergonomically perfect business for a post-pandemic that you couldn't have possibly anticipated. Is that what it sort of feels like to you as well?
It does. It does. It feels like that. We were just talking about this yesterday. So a year ago, we had 11 full-time employees at We Are Rosie. And we always use flex talent ourselves. There's always like a contingent of Rosies that are working on our business. We've hired 11 people just in the last like month and a half. So we're now at like 40 FTEs. Yeah. I mean, the growth that we've had since COVID started has been insane.
Right. And listen, the full-time employees are going to buy into the mission and buy into you. And then the network of 7,500, some of those are going to be go-tos that you come back to frequently. Some of those are going to be people that, you know, you've used once and never use again. And, you know, but we know that great companies start with great culture. Your values are very clearly defined. It's the first thing you see on your website. How hard is it to get part-time employees and contractors to buy into your culture and your values as if they were full-time employees?
Yeah, it hasn't been that hard for us. And I think it's because we're so loud about our values, right? They're not buried. You're not like, who are these people I'm getting involved with? And also, we're not a really like vanilla organization where you're like, oh, you could just like cut and paste We Are Rosie's kind of values and ethos onto any company and it would match. Like, we're okay with alienating some people if we stay true to who we are and our values. And we've always been that way, because for me, if I'm going to take this risk and leave my comfortable life to join, you know, entrepreneur land with two small children, like, I'm going to do it and be able to hold my head up high. Like, that is just, you know, something that I'm unwilling to compromise on. And so I think because we've been so loud, and we are an activist organization in a lot of ways, like, We Are Rosie is here to distribute wealth, access, and opportunity to people who are traditionally left out of the room when those things are doled out, right? Like, so at the surface, you're like, oh, it's a freelance platform or it's an independent talent platform. Yes. But the way that we work is so that we can connect people who have traditionally been underpaid, overlooked, underpromoted, marginalized, pushed out of organizations, and give them a life where they experience dignity, respect, and love in their work that they're doing, so that they are happier and healthier and wealthier.
As you talk about marginalized groups, I mean, you started the company in 2018. At that time, the conversation in the industry was around the lack of women in the industry broadly and in leadership positions specifically. As the industry has shifted its focus to other marginalized groups, do you feel like the part about women has been lost?
No, I don't. I mean, I think that there's still plenty of people beating the drum on the need for, you know, female leadership and pay equity and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But I think what we've realized, and Cindy Gallup talks about this a lot, the more female leaders we have, hopefully the less other problems we have, that like women, because they have experienced some level of marginalization and otherization, will look out for other groups of people. Of course, that's not always true. It's like hard to say anything with broad strokes. But I do know so many female entrepreneurs who are out there fighting for underrepresented groups of people and ensuring that they're represented and that they're paid properly and all of them promoted and all of these things that are important. But I still think there's, I still see plenty of people beating the drum. Of course, I live in a bubble and I follow people who are drum beaters, but I think that the progress is still coming along. Of course, none of it's as fast as we'd like.
Yeah. Going back to the talent piece, it's one thing to be contracted by a brand or another agency to get a freelance gig. It's another thing to be asked back again and again. And if it's predicated on talent, I wonder, besides the talent part of what you look for in people, what are some of the qualities that you sort of consistently see in the most sought after vendors who you guys find yourself continuing to come back to?
In terms of our clients?
Yeah, in terms of your talent network.
Our Rosies, yeah. Yeah. You know, our favorite Rosies are people that embody our core values, that, you know, are energized by our core values and who we are as a business and what we're looking to achieve, and also understand the responsibility. Like, there's a responsibility because we are pushing a model that has not been done before at scale and with brands that have not embraced it before, right? These global brands that have an opportunity to really shift the way people think about work. And there is a level of responsibility on everybody who's participating in this, our Rosies included, to make sure that we don't want to give anybody a reason to say, oh, we tried that new thing and it sucked. We tried that new thing and it didn't work, right? So people who take that responsibility seriously and understand that, like, we're all in this together, like, that's our culture, right? Our culture with our Rosies, and that's how it extends to our community, is like, we are here to normalize this way of working and to remove the shame and stigma and lack of access for people who want or need to work in this way. And we all have a responsibility to uphold the quality of the work that we're doing, the way that we show up every day, the way that we engage with our clients and with each other. And so, you know, by and large, that's how our Rosies are. And it's such a beautiful thing to see because they all have the most stunning stories I've ever heard in my life. I mean, we on the daily, we have a Rosies Are Rad Slack channel where we just drop. We're like, oh my God, this Rosie was on Jeopardy, or like, this Rosie just released a music album or started a summer camp. And so we're always in awe of the portfolio lives and careers that our Rosies live. And even more so when they're able to embrace those things while also delivering incredible results for a Fortune 10 client, right? Like, it's incredible. Yeah. And it's an honor to be a part of kind of normalizing this way of work, all of us.
When it comes to selling your model to clients, you brought it up, for some, it will require them to sort of let go of assumptions and stigmas about the qualities that they need to see in a quote unquote agency partner. What are some of the assumptions from prospective clients that you find yourself regularly having to address or sort of help them overcome in the early going?
Oh man, it's changed over time. So it used to be that remote work was even possible. Right. Like, that was the originally people were like, you're fucking crazy. Like, there's no way we can have a remote team in three different time zones running this big project for us. So that was like the initial kind of inertia that we felt when we started the company. Then it was you can't have creatives that aren't sitting in the same room, do creative work together. Now it's kind of to a certain extent, and people are opening up, but like, you can't have creatives that haven't worked together before. So they have to be people that have worked together before. And I'm like, well, that really decreases your ability to innovate, but like, we won't go too deep on that now. And then there's like some real tactical things, right? Where clients say, we don't even know how to onboard you, right? Like, are you an agency? No. Are you a staffing firm? No. Are you a consultancy? No. Can we look like all of these things depending on how you leverage our community of 7,500 people? Yes. But then their mind kind of explodes and they're like, well, we don't know how to onboard you. Like, can you just be an agency? No, we cannot. We're not an agency. So it's been really interesting to like see the evolution of, you know, feedback and pushback. And it was definitely like the first 2 years of this business was just like repetition and education and just drum beating. Like, this is an appropriate way for people to work. It actually works. And it was hard before we had case studies. See, now we've got really good case studies and we're like, oh, Facebook uses us, you know, like the WW uses us, like these huge brands are using us. And so that's definitely helped because people start to get FOMO and they feel less scared. But at the very beginning, we didn't have case studies and a lot of our work was done through holding companies and we couldn't name them. Like we couldn't even talk about it. So it's been a long road to kind of remove the concerns that people have. And I think I've learned a lot about human psychology, just in that people want to go back to what's comfortable for them. And we would have these brilliant meetings where we're like, we're this shape-shifting organization. You can do anything with us, right? Like just, we will give you your dream team. You give us the challenge, we'll give you your dream team. And they were like, oh, this is so cool. I love that, you know, I can get one Rosie or 20 Rosies. I'm so in, you got to talk to my boss. And then we'd talk to their boss and they'd say, so you're a staffing firm? Or they'd say, you're an agency. And then we'd have to do it all over again. And it was just a lot of repetition.
Which feels minimizing, right? I mean, no, we're not a staffing firm.
Yet. Oh my God. It was demoralizing for so long, but I get it, right? Because people are like, psychologically, we're all exhausted, right? We've all been in a pandemic for the last 18 months. So people are just like, give me something to relate this to that I know. Yeah. And it's made me think a lot about like, when Uber and Lyft started and they were trying to explain to people why you should do that instead of get a taxi, right? Or when Netflix replaced Blockbuster and how people are like, but is it like Blockbuster? And you're like, nope, totally different. You
know? Well, so, one of my favorite versions of that metaphor is Bob Odenkirk talked about this as he tried to expand his repertoire as an actor and as a director. And he said, you know, his observation is less like the human psychology is people will only let you do what they've seen you do. Mm-hmm. And so I think with, you know, big brands, it's like we work with agencies. So we'd really like it if you could look like this thing that we've worked with for 30 years or feel like, or sound like. And then at agencies, we'll do stuff like, we want to make a car ad unlike any car ad that's ever existed. Okay, let's start pulling some director reels. Obviously the person's going to need to have car experience. It's like, well, if you want it to look like something that's never existed before, has it occurred to you that you may want to get someone who's never done it? So you said you already said that you're never going to be an account director again. Given your business model, how do you show up with clients? What role do you play? Are you the CMO liaison?
Yeah.
How do you define it?
It's changed so much over the last year just because our team has grown. And I'll say, you know, we just kind of completed our leadership team with our COO, which was, I mean, a godsend and came in at the perfect time given the scale. But now, you know, I tweeted the other day, I think most of my job right now is just telling my team that their ideas are really good. And I've definitely realized that I have hired the most brilliant leadership team and our entire organization is just, I'm like so impressed with everybody here. And my job is to just clear shit out of their way and evangelize the mission and the vision and to constantly be looking around the corner at what's next because it's evolving so quickly. So I really have taken on this role recently of, you know, true visionary strategy, understanding adjacencies, like what's happening with healthcare and benefits for independent talent. And how are we making sure we're keeping an eye on that? Because that's going to free up a lot of people who are stuck in jobs they hate to come work in this way, because those are the impediments for them. So I'm constantly looking at what's next and how do we do better with our current model and how do we expand so that we can touch more lives and to just support my team. I mean, my job is to get out of their way. And one of the things I realized over the last year as our leadership team has really gelled and come together is like maybe a year ago, things would have sped up if I got involved. Like if we had a problem and I joined the call, I could expedite the solution, right? Like my presence and my input would help move things along. And now I slow shit down. So that's like a recent realization because the company is moving so fast and people have stood up all this process and like, I don't know everything anymore. Right. And so I've realized that if I try to get in the weeds, I mess my team up. Right. So it's been an interesting transition for me. And that realization was a big one because it happened so quickly. And you know, it's just like, okay, Steph, you got to like stop doing that. And you need to start looking ahead because everything else is under control by this incredible team. So I do a lot of client meetings, a lot of public speaking, a lot of turning partnerships into enterprise partnerships, which is like the next phase of our business, where maybe a brand has been using Rosie's for a year and they've had massive success. How do we now become your Flex Talent partner of record, right? Like, how do you plan for Flex Talent the same way you plan your agency budgets? So those are a lot of the big conversations we're having now. And in those conversations, I'm definitely the CMO liaison alongside my team.
We sell majority sweatshirts on our website with the proceeds going to the Shaquille O'Neal Foundation, which is a sort of an extension of the Boys and Girls Club of America. This morning, I packaged up 3 sweatshirts. I'm sort of assessing as I listen to you talk, maybe not the best use of my time packaging sweatshirts this morning.
Yeah, you got to outsource that.
Yeah.
Do you know what was really helpful for me? Somebody was like, Steph, assign an hourly amount for the value of your time in running this company. And then any task that comes up where you can outsource it for less than that dollarly amount, do it. And that was like really helped me reframe some things. Wow. It was like, oh shit, if I would charge clients this much for my time today and I'm packaging sweatshirts, like how do we delegate some of this?
I will remember that piece of advice for the rest of my life. Thank you. That's yeah. Very good. So let's talk about the benefits of remote working, which you were evangelizing before the pandemic, and it was a big part of the disruption of your model. And now it's quite normalized in a beautiful way. And you had this awesome, unanticipated head start. I think the benefits of remote working far outweigh the detriments. I know you agree.
Yep.
As an agency that's formed in a post-pandemic world, I'm wondering when or if we should ever get an office space. You know, I hear all the sort of old school managers and owners and CEO going, it's going to be great to get back. We all got to get back. It's like, I know why you're saying that is because you have to pay that commercial real estate bill, but it's not consistent with most of what your employees are saying. So what's your view of even just the need for physical workspaces anymore?
Yeah. Look, some people like it, right? And I don't ever want to dismiss that or minimize that, right? There are some people that want or need, the same way that a lot of people want or need to work independently or remotely, there are people that want or need to work in an office for any number of reasons, right? Like maybe they're a caregiver and they have an unwell relative in their house and they need that actual physical space to get out and focus on work. And so I think it's going to be like everything else, a hybrid. I think, for a million reasons, WeWork was not the solution, but yeah. I think that there's room for something like that to crop up and create these kind of brain centers where it's like a marketing co-working space, right? Or an advertising co-working space where majority has some space for their team to come in when they feel like it. And for people who are visiting from out of town that are other members of your team to congregate and be together, but to also be kind of buzzing with just the industry, yeah. right? And so you build a physical space for people that want or need it, you know, long-term or short-term, but they're surrounded by other people that are inspiring and actually are either adjacent or in the industry they're in so that we get that kind of magic that people talk about that happens in person. I'm actually an introvert, which is really surprising to a lot of people. I do not like going into an office. It has been like the battle of my life in corporate America to be like, I will get so much more done if you people will just leave me alone. Like, let me just stay at my house. But I do think we have to acknowledge that that's not how everybody is. And I think that there's definitely room for some massive evolution on the co-working space front.
Yeah, I'm the same way. But that's where I come back to your story about showing up early at AOL and the benefits of being seen by senior management as this, you know, this young firecracker roaming the halls at 7 in the morning. I would not have been able to leave ad school early and get a job at Crisp & Porter if not for sitting in Alex Boguski's office at 7 in the morning. Like, there is still a value to just walking up to the person who you're not supposed to talk to and start talking to them.
Yeah. But think about how technology has enabled us to do that virtually. So I'll tell you, we actually just extended an offer to somebody to join our team yesterday who just hit me up on LinkedIn. Never met this woman in my life, didn't know her, didn't have any, you know, first connections or close friends in common. And she just reached out and said, I'm a fan. I have been following you guys for a long time. I'd love a position on your team if something ever comes up and is a fit. And now she works here. Yeah. So I think that like we found ways to do that virtually. And we've also like, you know, via things like Twitter, which is how I feel like I know you, we've kind of democratized access to leaders. So there's other ways to go about it. But yeah, there is value in kind of face-to-face conversations. You know, like we all came together as a team, as a leadership team, and did annual planning recently. And it was the first time I had met some of my direct reports on our senior leadership team, and it was the first time most of them had met each other. And there is a magic that comes that I think, you know, not that we need to do it frequently, but that comes that makes kind of virtual communication post those in-person engagements easier and more seamless. Yeah. So again, like it's nuanced, you know?
Yeah. The Twitter thing is interesting. I mean, I've always historically used social media to sort of, you know, self-promote and show everybody how good everything is going in this thing I just made. And I do that despite the irony that when I open LinkedIn on a day when I'm feeling a little burnt out or frustrated and start scrolling, it's just like, okay, I realize how grotesquely well everybody's doing, because that's what the platform is primarily designed to do. And that's a good thing, by the way. It's a place for people to largely express positivity about their careers, about their work. You know, that's good. One thing I really appreciate about you, and I take lessons from, is that you also use social media to share when you're feeling nervous or anxious or overwhelmed. You know, I feel like I've learned really intimate details about you through tweets. And when people like myself see those sort of unvarnished, vulnerable moments from a successful person, I think it just makes us feel a little less alone and motivates us, like, you know what, you feel like this right now, but like at 5 p.m. today or tomorrow or next week, it won't feel this way. So just keep going. So it's all my way of asking you to just talk a little bit about how you use social media and how much you choose to share of your true self in social media.
Yeah, I'm like a social media late bloomer. So I just got on Twitter like maybe 2 years ago. And I just got on Instagram like in the last year. So I'm like really late to the party on these things. And, you know, Twitter has become like this bright light in my life, which is, you know, funny because I know so many people are like, oh, it's like where all the awful things happen. But I feel like I have found this little neighborhood on Twitter of like really good people and really supportive people and authentic leaders that inspire me, yourself included. And it has made me feel okay being vulnerable. Like I'm never comfortable, right? Like I tweet these things almost in spite of everything in my body that's like, don't do this, don't do this. You're like opening yourself up. But the truth is, we're humans, right? And one of the things that was the most eye-opening for me when I started We Are Rosie is I very quickly went from fighting for a meeting with an associate media director at an agency to meeting with CEOs of every holding company and every major agency in this country and on the planet, honestly. And that happened within the span of like a year for me. And I had always thought that the people at the top were something different. Like I was like, they're not like me. They're smarter than me. They're better educated than me. They have, you know, better ideas. And I got to know a lot of these people and realized they're not. Like it's not the difference between me and them is that they believe they belong here. And for the longest, I didn't believe I belonged here. And so I always want to show people kind of the human side of leadership. Like if there are people out there that look up to me or admire what we've built at We Are Rosie, I want them to know that like, I'm just a person. Like I was just a person with an idea and I have good days and bad days and I fuck things up and I have good ideas and bad ideas and all of it. And so I just wanted to be really honest because I was hoping that it would inspire even just one person to think like, oh, Steph's just like me, right? Or like we have so much in common than maybe they would have thought otherwise, so that they get kind of the courage and, kind of the thought to go do whatever it is that they want to do in their lives the same way I did.
Yeah. Is your business primarily direct to client or is it agency supplement or does it just sort of depend on the month or year?
Yeah, it's mostly direct to client now. Yeah. That's shifted over time.
I can speak for at least creative agencies when I say that part of how we market ourselves and the best sort of new business tool is through the PR ability of our creative work. For you, how important is, you know, PRing the successes that you generate for clients, the work you generate for clients? And does your model allow you to PR your work when so much of your model is sort of built on being kind of embedded in these large companies?
Yeah, that is such a good question because it's been a real struggle for us. So we have multiple times been asked to, you know, put together a creative team. And they're like, we want to see creative work We Are Rosie has done before. And I'm like, we can actually show you creative work that our Rosies have done for clients before, but it's irrelevant because we have 7,500 people and the odds of you getting this team that made this creative work are low, right? Whether they're available or whether they want to work on this project or all the other factors that go into us creating this team. And so we're in this interesting place where, and this is another kind of mind flip we're asking people to make, where they've chosen creative partners specifically based on their book and their previous work and what that company has done. You can't do that with We Are Rosie. So what we're asking our clients to do, which really like messes with people's heads, is buy into our model. Trust us that of our 7,500 people, we can put together your dream creative team. You just have to buy into the model and then we will co-create the team with you. Like you'll be really happy with everyone on the team. We'll show you their individual books and we'll work together to make sure that team is perfect. Mm-hmm. But they probably have not all worked together before and we're not going to pretend they have. So that's been really interesting because we're asking clients to take a leap of faith and say, okay, I'm going to allocate this budget to We Are Rosie because we can't, you know, we need the budget allocated so that we can start seeing if people are available because it changes so quickly. And it's been really cool. The clients that have done it have had enormous success. Like they all come back for more. We're doing it for Diageo and Facebook and these huge brands and they love it. But it was they had to have a leap of faith in our model because we aren't out there saying, you know, this is the type of work you can expect from We Are Rosie, because the truth is it varies so widely depending on the team. There's a million permutations of Rosies that we can pull together.
Yeah. You're the mother of two. Your company is named after your daughter. I wonder how motherhood may have changed your management approach. Your children are still relatively young, but they predate the business. But did being a mom change you as a manager?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like it has made me much more compassionate and empathetic. I've always been kind of like a lone shark, right? And that's how sales trains you. Like you go out and you eat what you kill and you're, you know, largely dependent on yourself. And having kids has really taught me how to be cooperative, right? Like that was a lesson that I needed to learn. And really the biggest lesson that I think I've learned from becoming a mother was actually through natural childbirth. So I had a home birth with my second daughter and my first daughter was born at Atlanta Medical Center on Boulevard. But they were both natural births, so unmedicated. And I really had to like train my brain throughout that whole process around what am I capable of? What is my body capable of? And I had to undo a lot of the things that culturally tell us, like, your body's not capable of much. Like you don't have good instincts in this area. Let us just put you through the baby having machine. And natural birth really taught me to expand my mind in terms of what I am capable of. That has definitely, that was like an awakening moment for me and has led to me continually asking myself, how do I need to expand my mind today to become the leader I need to be for this company and for this team and for the people that we have the privilege of representing. So that experience that 8 years ago today, my first daughter was born, opened up my eyes to this idea that like I can retrain my brain and I can expand, you know, my consciousness, honestly, in terms of what I'm capable of. And that will be a lifelong learning passion for me because I know the Stephanie that was at this company 3 years ago would not have been able to get this company where we're going. So I'm really proud of like the changes I've made, you know, myself and psychologically and mentally and spiritually that will allow me to be a good leader for this team into the future.
Yeah. The compassion and empathy is easy to observe and sort of comes through in all of your communication. But people are motivated in different ways and you work with so many people. And so some people do need to be pushed and need to be challenged in different ways. And I'm sure that that management version of you exists as well. Having said that, I wonder, do you worry more about being too hard on people or being too soft on people?
Too soft.
Yeah. I figured you'd say that.
Yeah. you know, it's funny, like I lead by example. I always say like, I love people who are self-motivated. I'm actually not a great manager. Like this is something I know about myself. Like if you're saying I need to work on this specific skill. And I, you know, I want my manager to help guide me on that. It's too micro for me. I love taking people who are great and making them the best. Like, I'm a maximizer all the way. And if things get too granular, I lose attention, frankly. And so this is something I really know about myself. And I tell everybody who comes to this company to work directly for me that that's how I operate and that those are my strengths and weaknesses. So I will take you as this really amazing person and I will expand your competencies and help you on that journey in a way that maybe you didn't even think you were capable of. Like, that's where I thrive. But like kind of day-to-day management and KPIs and all of that is like really hard for me. So I make sure that the people that I have hired that work with me and on my team are really good at those things so that they can support the rest of our organization. But that was definitely like, I just had to accept that like, that's not my jam.
Well, and once you know what you aren't, it allows you to surround yourself with those things that you aren't rather than trying to find, you know, baby Stephanies to surround yourself with, right?
Yeah.
You already gave me the amazing tidbit about, you know, putting an amount on my hourly value. So now I'm going to be greedy before we wrap up here. You're a successful entrepreneur. I'm a new entrepreneur. Stephanie, give me some good advice.
Oh my gosh. Ask people what you can be doing better. So this is something that I really try to be sincere about. And I ask for it outside of our organization and inside. I ask our Rosies, I ask our clients, I ask my team. Because one of the things that I realized is like, I have blinders on, like we all do, right? And also I've learned about myself that I'm naturally drawn to certain parts of this business and improving parts of this business and ignoring things I'm not great at. Right. So I always want people to be calling me out. And I ask people, I'm like, call me out, call this company out if we're not living up to our core values or we're not doing what we say we're going to do. So I think that, you know, just constantly kind of soliciting feedback from people and really kind of dealing with whatever a lot of people have shit around this where they're like, I take it really personally. And it's like, it's not right. Like people feedback can be given with love. And we've actually made that part of our core values at Rosie. So that's been really helpful for me because I've got blind spots and I've got a maximizer personality. I like to take things that people are really good at and make them better. And I like to ignore things that people are not good at or try to minimize exposure, right? I'm like, we'll just not do that, right? So it's important to have people tell you the truth and to encourage them to do that by having the right reaction when they do.
You are in my brain right now. Thank you for that. Okay, we're going to end with two quick questions and I'll let you go. The first is, what is the word or phrase of advertising jargon that you most loathe?
General market? Like, what the fuck is that? What are we talking about right now? Like, what do you really mean? What are you saying? And the fact that that's still being thrown around is really kind of mind boggling to me.
It means white people, right?
Yeah, I think it means white people.
Yeah. And the second question is, what is the most memorably mortifying response you've ever gotten in a client meeting?
I mean, to go back to our earlier conversation, it's probably when people are like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. We don't know how to work with you. Right. Let's talk to procurement. And then I'm like, oh God, I'm dead.
Yeah. That word, it's like everything's going so well. And then when that word comes out, it's like in slow motion, like procurement. Oh shit.
I'm going to be seeing that, hearing that at 3 a.m. tonight. Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned before, the ways that you publicly discuss your entrepreneurial journey, warts and all, has been a huge help to me personally, and I know to others like me. And you have a way of sort of saying what I didn't realize I needed to hear in certain exact moments. And that's actually happened a bunch. So I just want to thank you for being a huge inspiration as an Atlanta entrepreneur. And showing that the South got something to say. It's great to meet you today.
That's right. It's so lovely to meet you too. I'm such a fan. It's an honor to be here.
All right. Talk to you again soon. And thanks again. That's it. We did it.
We did it.
That was
awesome. So good.
You know what I love about this is like, that's the conversation that I'd really love to have with you in the first hour we spend together. But if we just met for coffee, it would be way too weird.
I know. You know. Actually, I don't think it would. I think we would have that exact conversation.
Well, I wouldn't, it forces me to prepare. I wouldn't have been that prepared, but yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Conversation either happens through this medium or if we met and after like a third drink, then it's like,
yeah.
So your business, tell me exactly about all of it.
I know. We need to hang out. We got to find time. What are your days like now? Is it batshit crazy?
You know, one thing I learned at Crispin Porter, which was a sweatshop of an agency, is like, don't get caught up in like what nights are supposed to look like or what weekends are supposed to look like and what weekdays are supposed to look like. When the world gives you the moment to rest, take the rest. Mm-hmm. And when you have to work and don't. And so that's always worked really well for me. So it's all my way of saying it's really batshit crazy for like 3 or 4 days in a row, or from like 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. And then there'll be these weird pockets from like 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on a Wednesday where it's like, I think I could go sit in a steam room right now.
Yes, you know? Yes, that is my life. I'm like, what the fuck? Why is my calendar like this today? I don't have shit to do.
Yeah. And accepting that it's okay to not feel guilty about doing something restorative in the middle of a weekday and being yeah, dude, but you worked all Saturday and all Sunday. So, but still, because we're the children of immigrants. That guilt's not going anywhere.
Omid, so I usually get up at 4 or 4:30 and like meditate and do physical therapy shit and then start working. And the only other person awake at 4 a.m. every fucking day is my 77-year-old dad. I call my pops and he's like, at 6 a.m., my dad is sitting in the parking lot of Dillard's at North Point Mall waiting for the cleaning people to come so he can give them shit for not getting there early enough and let him in so he can go to the tailor shop. and get his shit done.
Same. My dad goes to bed at 7 p.m. and then he wakes up and he records. He'll record like the NBA finals and he wakes up and he just starts watching sports at 4 a.m. Like, you know what? That actually appeals to me in my 70s.
Yeah. I know. I love it. Where do your parents live?
They still live in Tucson. My dad owned a country western bar for 40 years. So he's got these awesome pictures of him with like Willie Nelson before Willie Nelson had a beard and Johnny Cash.
Oh my God.
So,
what?
Yeah, it's really cool. And they're still there. They're retired. The bar became this like sort of local country music landmark that's still there. He like sold the business to somebody.
Oh
so
my God.
My dad's the Iranian cowboy.
What the fuck? That is so cool.
All right. I'm going to let you go. We'll follow up soon, but thank you so much for making the time to do this.
Of course. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, thank you so much to the great Stephanie. Thank you, as always, to the executive producer of this podcast, Jeff Fiorello at JSM Music. And folks, if you are enjoying the podcast enough to make it to this outro, I ask you again, as I always do, to please subscribe, rate, review, share it with a friend or colleague. I appreciate all your support. And until we talk again, peace.